Welcome to Bare Roots,
the podcast that unearths the truth.
Allegedly.
We're your hosts. I'm Alina.
And I'm Shannon.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Bare Roots Podcast. Today's episode, we're talking about something. I don't know if you guys have heard of it because I personally had it. Shannon, you're the one who brought it up. So I'm so glad you did, because we are going to unravel this mysterious world known as the Voynich manuscript. And it's not really a world, but it kind of is, because it's a book that people don't really know a lot about. I don't know the author. There's just a lot of unknowns, but we're going to talk about it. But before we do, Shannon, how are you feeling today?
Feeling really good. I don't remember how I came across this topic, but it did elicit wonder and mystique on me.
Yes.
And I put it on our little list of topics to talk about. And now that we're out of April, got that, you know, pushed away, we can go on to some more mysteries. Yeah. Alina and I were talking before we hit record, but we were both reading this as Voynich manuscript, but I decided to just like try to find the pronunciation just to make sure that we were saying it right. And what I could find online was Voynich. So I guess we're going to go with that. But could be either way in my mind.
Right. And we don't know the real or correct answer, so don't hate us.
Right. We tried our best. We did look it up.
We really tried our best. We did as much research as possible, and this is the answer we got. So don't hate us.
So the Voynich manuscript is, like Alina said, it's a mysterious book with an unknown author, with an unknown language. And that's the real kicker, is that so many people have tried to decode this thing and nobody can detect the language.
Yeah.
All of the linguistics in the world cannot figure it out.
At first I thought it wasn't real because there was just so many unknowns. I'm like, is this a folklore story? Like, that was kind of what I was thinking when I first was reading about it. But no, it's actually a real thing.
Yeah, you can see it in one of Yale's libraries, and they do have it scanned. So I kind of did flip through a few pages of it because I wanted to see the illustrations, but we'll get to that later.
Yep.
So this is a 234-page document that was carbon dated actually pretty recently. I think it was in 2009 that they were able to do this. And it carbon dates back to the pages to between 1404 and 1438, which I just love carbon dating. Like, how do we get that specific? We get it within 34 years of when this parchment was made.
Wow.
It's pretty wild. It's pretty well known that this was located in Central Europe, and it was most likely during the Italian Renaissance it was created. So it is 225 millimeters tall and 5 centimeters thick. And the pages are made from calf skin, which it's about 14 to 15 calves, which is a fun little math trick that I'm sure somebody was really pleased to do. The sheets themselves were actually of just like an average quality. We're not talking like beautiful, beautiful parchment, or it's actually vellum, but they said it was like basically good, but there were some inconsistencies. So it's not like, you know, an emperor or a king had this be done.
Yep.
There was an original theory, but has since been debunked because of the radiocarbon dating. And the original theory was that this book was created by scientist Roger Bacon in the 13th century. However, the book was made after that. And Roger Bacon really, like, that name was in my head. I was like, we definitely talked about that in like high school history or something. He died in 1292. So again, it was after his time. But Roger Bacon was the first European to describe in detail how to make gunpowder. And he had many other inventions and designs for like flying machines and motorized ships, which that's pretty cool.
Yeah, very ahead of his time.
Motorized ships in 1292. Barely had normal ships. No, I'm just kidding. Other people thought that Da Vinci made it, but he was born in 1452. So it doesn't really add up there either. The manuscript is divided into 6 sections based on illustration. So we should note that this book is both text and illustration, and we can't read the text. No language.
Yep.
compares to it to this day. But the illustrations, we can kind of, it's a little bit easier to decode, although they are whimsical in nature as well. Like, they still kind of look foreign and alien.
Yes, this is definitely the part of the manuscript that I am interested in. Like, I found this, the sections, interesting.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. So the first section is botany, and that's the largest one. There's 113 detailed, colorful drawings of plants and herbs, and there's text written around the imagery. Again, this is the largest section of the book. So most of it is this. And when you look at it, you can see plant life, but it's not like detailed drawings that you think of when you think of like botany drawings. It's very, I don't want to say juvenile, but kind of.
Kind of, yeah.
And I mean, I know this is a long time ago, but also there were a lot of middle-aged pieces of artwork that were better done than this. You know what I mean? Like, it's just kind of like they weren't painting it in the lines, you know? Yeah. Things spilled over.
Yep.
So it is whimsical. The second section is astronomy and astrology. So there are 12 pages of the that depict arrangements of the stars, the sun, the moon, and some pages featuring zodiac symbols. What do you think about that, Alina?
I love, like, this is honestly right up my alley.
I know. There are a few words that they have been able to piece out of this book, and like a few words, like 10 words. And they are some of them are the zodiac signs, because they were either exactly the Latin word for them or they were like very close.
So they knew.
Yeah.
Or could at least try to correlate it to the zodiac signs.
Exactly. The next section is biology, which this depicts drawings of nude women intertwined with and connected by like tubes and flowing. It certainly looks like flowing liquid. I wouldn't necessarily call it tubes. When I read that, I thought, what? This seems pretty alien-y. Why are women attached to tubes? Alien-y. Yeah. But I looked up the photos, or I was, you know, going through the book, the digital copy, and it honestly looks like a bath. Like, it looks like it's women, naked women standing in almost like a basin, and then water being poured on, almost like a shower, I guess. There is a tube in which water is like being poured on them. So, and it's kind of the same thing for every page.
Yep.
Like a woman standing in what looks to be a basin of some sort, and then water being put on her. And I did see that some people think that they're all pregnant, and there is like the stomach does protrude, but I don't know if I can like say.
Like, is she pregnant or just, you know, the natural woman's body?
Right. Before editing.
Exactly. Like, maybe she ate that day. I don't know.
She has some bloat. I don't know.
Yeah. We shouldn't body shame. You know, like, people shouldn't be like evaluating it that hard.
Right. Right. The next section is cosmology. And this includes drawings of 9 medallions filled with stars and other shapes, which, interesting. Cool. Next section is pharmaceutical. And this is more plants and herbs, but they depict what is thought to be like medical plants. And they also include drawings of very elaborate jars and bottles and things. Then the last section is continuous. It's basically all text, but there's decoration marking the beginning of short entries. And they could be, people think that they might be recipes. So this book has a lot of things going on, a lot of different sections.
Yeah, lots going on, a lot of different topics. And I don't know, I just think it's so interesting that they can't figure it out, because the lettering is pretty much the English alphabet. It's not like it's in like hieroglyphic, totally obscure language. But when you read it, you're like, this is gibberish. What does this mean?
Yeah, I thought the letters looked almost like a mix between English and Arabic or something. There's like the swoopiness of it that kind of doesn't look quite what we're used to.
Yep.
So they've made pretty good attempts at identifying the plants that are illustrated in it. And people feel fairly good about that. But again, nobody has been able to decipher the text, and the language in it is referred to as Voynichese. Voynichese. It's written left to right with no obvious punctuation. There are a couple pages that have, like I said, the Latin on them. Mm-hmm. And it does have a highly regular structure. So there are some letters that show up often like vowels would for us. And then there are some symbols that like only begin a word or they only end a word. So it kind of, it definitely follows a structure. It's not just, or some people believe it's not just gibberish. So throughout history, this has come in and out. And it was first, you know, we can tell that it was made in 1404 to 1438, but the first time that it's actually documented as being a real thing was the late 1500s to the early 1600s. And that was because it was in the library of the Holy Roman Emperor Rudolf II. So I believe he was in Germany. That's pretty solid. Like, they have pretty good evidence that it was there. Because there was a letter that was written about it, and it was in between a few pages when it was more recently discovered. How we know it today is because of Wilfried Voynich, hence the name of the manuscript. And he discovered it and or rediscovered it in 1912. He was a rare books dealer, and he bought it from the Jesuits. We'll get into a little bit more of that timeline, and because it's one of the theories, it's not proven, but we'll get it into the in the theory aspect of it. But yeah, Wilfried Voynich, he was the one that it's named after, which I always thought was curious because it feels like you're like the last owner of it.
Yeah, exactly. This thing is so old, and you're getting the credit for it.
Yeah, it's been around for 500 years, and you get your name on it.
Yep.
But I guess that's what happens when you don't have a cover with a title. One of the most well-known cryptologists tried to break the code of this book. His name was William Friedman, and he actually broke one of Japan's codes in World War II, and he tried to decode it, the manuscript, but he couldn't really figure it out. And his conclusion was that it was an early attempt to construct an artificial or universal language.
I thought this was so interesting. I love that we're using a well-known cryptologist. And honestly, that whole subject is just very fascinating to me.
Yeah.
And it makes me think, I want to say in fifth grade when we went to that Native American museum, and they were talking about how in World War II, they were so beyond smart where they wrote in the language of like the Native Americans, and they had them help create, you know, their own language. So when the enemies did decode it, they were left with a language that they had nothing about or knew nothing
about. I don't remember that. That's so cool.
Yeah, that is genius. So if the word was, I don't know, house, it would have been, they would have decoded it, but it would have been like the Iroquois word for house.
Yeah. That's so cool.
Yeah. And I'm like, oh my God, and that makes so much sense because obviously the Europeans and the Japanese, they weren't really privy. They probably didn't have someone who could translate Native American because obviously it's on the U.S. soil. So I'm like, that is genius.
Yeah. It doesn't seem like a real job. You know, like how often does this actually come up that we need to code things?
Right. But I don't even know where do you start. It's very fascinating.
And there's so many different kinds that you don't even know about. It's very national treasure.
Yes, exactly.
That's what I was thinking with this. I'm like, all we need is Nick Cage. You would figure it out.
Yep. Your personality must be so, so strong. Like, you have to be so determined and willful and never give up.
Very organized. I feel like you have to have very meticulous notes. As you're trying to break something.
Yep.
In 2014, Brazilian researchers used a complex network modeling to show that the text displays similar linguistic patterns to that of known languages. So they weren't able to translate the book, but they were very much like, this is an actual language. This is an actual language. It follows the same patterns, because a lot of people just said it was completely made up. So they were trying to debunk that. But since, I think, 1969, the book has lived in one of Yale's libraries. It kind of passed around between, well, it passed around between a lot of people over the
many 500 many years.
Yeah. But once it became known better to us in the modern century, they it passed by a few hands from 1912 until 1969, but now it's been there for since then.
Yeah. So you can literally go check it out, or you can just go online and read it. I saw you can like download like a PDF version of it. Yeah. Like, what? That's insane.
That is so cool. Yeah. Like give everybody the knowledge.
Yes.
You could totally try to decode it at home.
Yeah. Maybe it'll be you.
Let us know.
Yeah. Let us know. What a great project. Alrighty, let's dive into the theories, and we actually have a good amount of them to talk about. But before we do, let's first hear a word from our sponsor. Alrighty, we are back. So Shannon was talking about earlier, we're going to dive a little bit deeper with the story of the emperor, who was the guy who purchased the book. So Rudolf II reigned from 1576 to 1611. So he's kind of like your medieval guy.
I was looking up Middle Ages because I kind of like, I'm like, I need to remember our timeline. Like, where are we in history?
Yeah.
And so we are not doing great. the bubonic plague and, you know, killing half of Europe's population. I forget. I don't know how far it went, but at least half of Europe's population was like kind of around this time.
Just to set the scene, to paint the picture, it's dark. Because I'm trying to think, what is a Renaissance? Renaissance is after the bubonic plague and all that, I imagine. We're flourishing, we're living.
Yeah, I believe so. They break up the Middle Ages into three chunks. And so we're in the like middle of the Middle Ages.
We are truly in the Middle Ages.
Okay. So yes, when the book was made, we had just gotten over all of the death of the bubonic plague.
Mm-hmm.
So it ended in 1353. And so 1404.
Mm-hmm.
It's tough, you know, it's tough life. Half your friends are dead, you know?
Yeah, we're recovering.
Yeah. But now it's been some time when we have Emperor Rudolf II. So he's feeling better. He's throwing out the cash.
Yeah, he's diving into the arts. And with the arts, he decided to potentially, allegedly, own this manuscript. So there's this one hypothesis was that he purchased it for 600 ducats. Believing it was written by Roger Bacon, you know, the mathematician, the one and only, and oculist John Dee. And John Dee was working under Elizabeth I, who is just beyond iconic. And I could go into like a whole PhD type of alum, you know, writing, but I won't. I'll spare the details. And had many of the works of Roger Bacon. So he said that he had about 630 ducats in October of 1586, and his son noted that his dad, while in Bohemia, owned a, quote, book containing nothing but hieroglyphics, which book his father bestowed much time upon, but I could not hear that he could make it out. Wow, it was really difficult because I didn't really tap into my middle ages.
The spelling was really
yeah,
a lot of extra vowels in there.
Exactly. So picture that in your medieval tome. And so basically, long story short, his dad, you know, had this book that really tied really well with a description of the Voynich manuscript. And, you know, it's like, where did the money go, you know? And according to the website, 600 ducats would about be equivalent to $133,000 today, which is wild.
Yeah, that was me doing rough numbers. When you type in ducats to USD, surprisingly, not much comes up.
Shocking.
But that the weight in gold that it would be worth, of the ducat coin. So I'm sure if you actually had ducat, the it itself would be worth more because it's like a historical item, but right. the gold in which it was would be 133,000 today. So Emperor Rudolph was willing to throw some money around.
That podcast math.
This is not a math podcast.
Yeah, this is a podcast math, so take it with a grain of salt.
Right,
but I liked it. I thought your explanation, it really made sense to me, so I sign off on that.
Yeah, so I guess the least amount of money it would be is that much, but it's probably right. worth more.
Right. So the notion that the book was purchased by Rudolph came from a letter written in 1665, so quite a bit of time later, by a Prague scientist named Johannes Marcus Marchi. And I'm pretty sure the CI makes the chi sound, if I'm correct. Am I right, Shane?
In Italian, it does. I don't know about Italian. In Prague.
That's true. It is true. Okay, so it could be Marcy. So anyways, his friend, an alchemist, and later a recipient of the manuscript, George Barshish of Prague, again, totally messed that up. The letter was tucked within the pages of the manuscript when Voynich purchased it in 1912. So it is known for certain that the manuscript was owned by Rudolph's court chemist and pharmacist, Jacobus Horkiki de Tempenek, who left his thank you so much. I really needed that validation. who left his signature, which was detected with an ultraviolet light, on folio 1R of the book, for the first part of the book.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. That's so basically the book traveled between the alchemist friends until it ended up with the Jesuit priest Ethan. That's an interesting name, Karcher. So it's like the traveling book between yeah. friends. And I think that makes some sense to me. There's a tie somehow, some way. I don't know if he necessarily Rudolph purchased it, question mark on that, but it was in the family, I think.
And then it stayed with the Jesuits for a freaking long time until the 1912 when they needed to, you know, make some cash. So they started selling their books. And that's when Voynich picked it up. No, I think that makes sense.
Yeah, I think it's valid.
I don't know anything about it, but I like the idea of being an alchemist in the Middle Ages. If I could be in that time, I'd love to have my little, like, I don't know, studio and trying out different things, what goes with what.
Be so, like a little, your potions, I picture.
Yeah. But I just like the idea that this book traveled between like alchemist friends, like they're all buddies and they're like, hey, what are you trying over there?
I see.
Have you tried to read this? Yeah, thank you.
Just not Salem Witch Trials time era, you know, sharing the knowledge.
Yeah. Or like, you know, dabbling with materials that kill you, like Madame Curie, you know?
Oh yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm.
That'd be good.
But we also got to talk about kind of like the flip side, right, of this Voynich manuscript, and just flat out, it could just be a hoax, right? So some suspect Voynich having fabricated the manuscript himself, and that the manuscript written by Roger Bacon, talked about earlier, who would have gone a lot of money. And then as an antique book dealer, he probably had the necessary knowledge and means to kind of cook something up for himself. And the letter linking the manuscript to Roger Bacon, which was written back in the 1600s, just mentions a manuscript. So it could have been anything. And Voynich could have slipped it into the manuscript. So it's like, did he meddle in with kind of the truth and played a little part in this? So these letters could possibly have been the motivation for Voynich to fabricate the manuscript, assuming that he was aware of them. Dun, dun, dun. So even though the pages date back to 1404 to 1438, so again, early 1400s, some people believe maybe it was just blank paper and Voynich wrote and drew on top of it. Shooketh. And this theory is largely debunked, although due to the carbon dating. So because of that technology, historians have argued that it's almost impossible to think that a large stack of blank vellum would have survived for 500 years, which is valid. Yeah, Shen, what do you think? Where's your tinfoil hat on this?
I like the idea of just picturing blank vellum in a J.B. Mason box, like the paper that
Yeah. Like, and you like hold just... it up to the light and you can see like a little watermark.
And every time you move, you just bring this box with you because it's like, it's not like going bad. Yeah. So then like for 500 years, this vellum stuck around. But yeah, like I like the idea of it. I think it is a plot twist to think that the paper was made and then a long time later, something was drawn on top of it. I just don't think it was that long, you know, maybe I'm going out on a limb here, but you know, we said Da Vinci was born in 1452. What if he got his hands on it when he was 16 or something? And the paper would have only been, you know, like a few decades old.
Could this possibly be Da Vinci's code? Like shots fired, drop, like mind blown.
That's it.
Yeah. Case closed, podcast over. Can't continue. The mic was dropped.
I don't know what to do with it now. But I do think the biggest component that I could say that points towards this whole hoax thing is the fact that it's named after him. Of course, if he made the book, he'd be like, we're going to call it the Voynich manuscript.
Yep.
However, I do think it would have been a lot of work for X amount of money.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
What about you?
I agree. I think I can see why people might think that. But it's really the carbon dating thing that just gets me, you know? It's just like, okay, we thought about this theory, could see it, you know, just messing around. But at the end of the day, the proof is in the pudding. This guy didn't write it.
It just seems like a lot of work. You have to look at the reward, you know? Although he's a rare books dealer, so maybe he has a lot of time on his hand. Maybe it was like a passion project. I don't know.
Let's dive into the words of it all, right? Like what are people thinking? What could it possibly be? What were these people trying to communicate? And people think that this language is a cipher created to try to hide something, which really piques my interest. So according to this theory, the language in the manuscript is actually a European language that was intentionally rendered obscure through a cipher to hide whatever what was written. So each letter was given another letter / symbol, and it completely hides the meaning unless you know the cipher. Oof. Okay, let's dive in. So this was the working hypothesis for the most 20th century deciphering attempts, including an informal team led by William Friedman in the early 1950s. So the main argument for this theory is that it is difficult to explain a European author using a strange alphabet, except as an attempt to hide information. So even Roger Bacon knew about ciphers back in the day and estimated for the date for the manuscript roughly coincide with the birth of cryptography in Europe as a relatively systematic discipline. So it's like people are talking, people are kind of doing this thing.
It's hot.
And like it's kind of fun. So I can see why it like blew up. But there's obviously, you know, you got to have the other spectrum. So the counter argument to this is that it's not that simple. So it's not simple because to replace a letter for a symbol cipher, many researchers have already looked into that and it's just really difficult. So, and the letter frequencies don't match up to any known language. But honestly, isn't that the point?
Yes.
So I don't know. Like, is that valid? Is that a good counter argument? So is it possible that the text was encrypted by starting from a fundamentally simple cipher, then augmented by adding different types of ciphers on top of it? So some people believe that there was a code book previously to decipher it, because obviously you need the cheat code, like a dictionary for the manuscript. So I don't know, like, we don't have the answer, but a lot of people think this is the purpose of the book, is to hide something.
Yeah, because I mean, if you have one cipher and then you like keep scrambling it, then it's pretty hard to freaking break after that.
Yep. Honestly, my tinfoil hat is pretty much on my head, and it really connects beautifully with my theory that I'm going to tie in with this. So I could believe it. I think it's a secret code. I don't know if it's supposed to be another language, but rather it is just cryptography.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm sold. What about you, Shannon?
My tinfoil hat is definitely like in my hands. I'm not going to put it in complete coordination, but it's like almost there.
Okay.
It's like at forehead level. It hasn't like gone over my head, but it's there.
It's approaching. What makes you not think that it's cryptology then?
Because I have a different theory that I like better, and I'll say at the end.
Wow, guys, this is such an interesting episode, because I feel like we, for the most part, always agree. So could we be differing? This is good. Okay. Shannon, take it away with the next theory.
So the next theory is that the text is mostly meaningless, but it contains meaningful information hidden in the inconspicuous details. So this is called steganography. That word feels like it's a dinosaur and a cryptology tactic in one. Stegosaurus. Steganography.
Stegosaurus.
Yeah. Never heard that word before in my life.
Mm-mm.
So the way that this kind of works is that, for instance, there could be like the second letter of every word, you take that and then you add that up, and that is the secret message. Or the numbers of letters in each line mean something. And steganography is very old, and it was described first in 1499, so not as old as the paper. In some cases, an overlay, like a cutout, will be placed over the page, and whatever letters show through the cutout are the meaningful text. Which is pretty cool. There's just so many ways to like code things, you know?
So many, yeah.
But most people think that this overlay system is unlikely, because the text isn't like written that uniformly, and it's not even that straight on a line. So it'd be hard to like, you kind of need a grid if you're going to use that cutout, you know? But it's one of those things that's hard to disprove, just because there are just so many different kinds of coding. And if we don't have that cutout, then we can't do anything. You know what I mean? Like, you have to have the cutout.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
I apologize if you hear the people upstairs, but they decide to walk very loudly during this podcast. Don't they know?
We're recording. Silent on set.
So the next theory is glossolalia, another word that I did not know. But it's also known as speaking in tongues, which that kind of sent shivers down my spine when I saw that as a possible outcome. So some people suggest that the Voynich manuscript may be a case of glossolalia. Glossolalia.
Lalia.
Glossolalia.
Glossolalia. Yay.
Yay. So that's, again, speaking in tongues. Also, it could be channeling or art. Outsider art. So
we're talking like Harry Potter type of thing, speaking in snake.
No, I mean, yeah. I was thinking more of like exorcisms with demons, but yeah, we could parcel tongue, we can use too.
We can use parcel tongue. Okay, because that's what I was thinking, but I guess it's the lighter version. Okay.
So in this theory, the author felt compelled to write large amounts of text in a manner which resembles stream of consciousness, and it was either because of the voices they heard in their head or because of, you know, an inexplicable urge to do so. This often takes place with invented languages when speaking in tongues, and it's usually made up of fragments of like the author's own language. And although invented scripts are kind of rare, So there was actually a, what's the word? Like, I guess like, just an example of this actually happening. A woman named Hildegard von Bingen.
Begin?
Begin? We're doing great. We're doing great with the... When I read that name, I was like, oh, like, she's probably more modern than what we're talking about, right? Mm-hmm. Probably something. No, this is a saint from the 1100s, so we're taking it back 300 years.
Whoa.
Apparently, there are some similarities between her and the Voynich manuscript. The illustrations that she drew when she was suffering from severe bouts of migraine, which can induce trance-like states prone to like speaking in tongues, the illustrations were kind of similar to what we have here. So that's where they kind of created this theory from, was like maybe somebody, you know, was going through stuff wrote it all down. Again, this is another, like all of these theories, it's virtually impossible to prove or disprove because like,
right,
sure, you know, like it's kind of right, right. Like, yeah, maybe we'll never know if the author, right, you know, like there's, if they were just speaking to, no way for us to know that.
Yeah.
But this is kind of, I guess I'll put in my theory on this one because it's similar. Okay, so my theory is we have examples in present day of authors creating different worlds and creating different languages that go with the world. Not unlike your parcel tongue, Alina. I was thinking more of like, you know, the elven languages in Lord of the Rings or Game of Thrones. Mm-hmm. We have, and there are authors that go into, they actually make the language, you know, like they actually go through and make the language. The difference being is that most of the book is written in English, but then they speak, you know, in their High Valyrian or whatever you want to call it for certain points. But I'm thinking maybe this is just, you know, a work of fiction. And the author was just trying to make a new language. They're writing a story about plants and women.
And the zodiac signs.
You know, it's just kind of like an idea. You know, it's kind of like a hobby project of just making a new language. Like, why not? There's so few things to do back in 1438.
Right. Yeah,
let's burn the midnight candles and like work on this little hobby project.
Yeah,
that's where my tinfoil hat is.
I'm kind of like in the last point you made where it's like, sure, you know, you can't I can't disprove you, and there's also no proof that it is, so why not,
right? Why can't it be? And I think it's like, again, I don't want to mock the artist, but the artwork did seem juvenile, and it just feels like I'm just picturing a pimply 16-year-old boy, and he's just really trying to write something, make something for himself.
Okay.
He's a good writer, but not like the best artist.
Yeah. And you're using those clues to help come up with your tinfoil hat kind of observation.
Well, I just think about that all the time with, I guess maybe now, I thought about this all the time with Harry Potter. I'm like, what if, you know, civilization collapses, the next civilization comes up, they find a copy of Harry Potter, and they're like, oh my God, were there really witches and wizards flying around? You know, like, that's kind of how I feel about this one. It's like, why can't we have works of fiction in the past?
In another language.
Another language. Again, we have examples of other languages or made-up languages that are pretty good linguistically to real languages.
Yeah.
That's where my tinfoil hat is. And I know there's not too much evidence, but I just like the idea of it.
Yeah. Why not? Hilary Duff said, you know, why not?
Thank you. Do you want to take it away on the fun little Reddit theories?
Yeah, of course, there are Reddit theories. When is there not a Reddit theory? And, you know, we talked about, could it be part of like a lost language? Maybe it's a fake language. I don't know. But I think that's a good one, too. Because, again, like maybe it's just a lost real language that this civilization just shriveled up and went away. The theory that I really kind of like is that the manuscript might be written by nuns. as a reference to Maria of Castile, the Queen of Aragon. And people connect the herbal remedies that we, talked about earlier with the different sections of the plants. Mm-hmm. And could it be therapeutic bathing and the astrological readings connected to the female mind? So it's like, could this manuscript be written about a woman's perspective in the medieval era, and possibly, and I'm going to tie back to what we said earlier, in code, because being a woman is so hard, it is so challenging. You're literally considered property and you're so much less than a man. And these things just, they really do kind of tie in with more of a female vibe in terms of the content. So I think it could be fun that, maybe women weren't allowed to really write and get creative, maybe tying to what you're saying, do the fantasy writing a book. So they just created their own book.
They also weren't taught to read or write. So yeah, maybe they're making up their own language because they're like, well, nobody's teaching me. I'm just going to do this on my own.
Exactly. So that's where my tinfoil hat is. I feel very good that if I had to bet money, I think a woman wrote it, not a man.
That'd be cool.
And could she have been writing it to protect herself or whatever? Because obviously back then the freedom wasn't free.
That is true. I have another theory that I just came up with.
Take it away.
As we were talking, I was thinking about, alchemy, alchemists. We've talked about alchemists before. All right. We did an episode on Philosopher's Stone. When was that? Mm-hmm. What was the time period? I just pulled up our notes and Nicholas Flamel died in 1418 at the age of 88. What if he wrote this right before he died?
Whoa. So it's not Da Vinci's code. It is Nicholas Flamel.
It's Nicholas Flamel. And it's coded because what could be so important? It's coded because it tells you about the Philosopher's Stone, the secret of life.
Oh my God.
That's it.
This is so good. This episode is just filled with mind blown information. We are just connecting so many things.
So many things.
Oh my goodness. This is such an informational episode. I'm just really obsessed with the knowledge that we are spreading.
I cannot wait for everybody to listen because I want to hear everybody's theories. Because it's pretty much open-ended. Whatever you think could have been a thing.
Exactly. Pretty valid. Sure, why not?
Those are the best kind of episodes when it's just no ifs, ands, or buts.
Exactly. Well, we definitely want to hear what you guys have to think and say. So let us know on Instagram. Follow us at BareRootsPod, B-A-R-E. And let us know. We'd love to hear what you have to say. And while you're there, leave us a 5-star review. Tell us that you're loving the pod. Hopefully you are on Apple Music, Spotify, whatever you're listening to. We are there. And stay tuned. We'll see you guys in a couple weeks for our next episode. But until then, talk to you all later. Bye.
Bye.